Today marks the 51st anniversary of the 1967 uprising in Detroit, the rebellion or riot that left 43 people dead and thousands of buildings in the city destroyed. Michigan Radio did a deep dive into the history and legacy of that event last year, and you can find all of those stories by heading to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. This year, we focus on the smaller rebellion that started 2 days later in Grand Rapids. For an historical overview of what happened in Grand Rapids July 25th, 1967, we turn to Matthew Daly, Associate Professor of History at Grand Valley State University. Matthew, set the scene for us. What was life like if you were an African American living in Grand Rapids in the 1960s?
The African-American community in Grand Rapids during the 1960s had grown dramatically in terms of size since before the Second World War, yet it was still largely located in the southeast part of the city along Division Avenue and around Hall Street and the like. It's an area that was in many ways very segregated away from the rest of the city. It was kind of a city within a city. The growth of the community had come from the opportunity for new manufacturing positions. For a long time, the furniture industry in Grand Rapids had only really had a small black community working within it. But with the growth of auto parts and other sorts of industries, it drew a larger number of migrants from the south to the area, and also from Detroit. People moved around to different opportunities. General Motors had a large stamping plant along 36th Street. So it was a growing community, but it was still largely isolated. In many ways, there were only a limited number of opportunities for retail, for education. And that was a real point of contention. Paul Phillips, the head of the Grand Rapids Urban League, a very significant figure in the city's history, had really sort of identified that all the way in the 1950s. And it was not really something that just sort of popped up overnight.
So take us to July 25th, 1967. What was the spark that set off these 3 days of disorder?
That's a really challenging sort of question. It depends on who you ask. There's several versions of what really got it started. The first is that there was a report of African-American youths breaking into a car and the police came. There was a scuffle and a young man fell and was injured, and therefore it drew a crowd. There's another that young men were throwing sort of rocks and stones at buildings and at white-owned businesses. There's another that there was a traffic stop. And really, at least for me, it's less that there was some sort of spectacular event that really started it. It triggered a response that people just got tired. This had gone on quite a bit. There had been a lot of tension within the community. There had been unhappiness with police and neighborhood relations. There had been an effort to start to address that. There had been a very strong sort of a real unease and a clear definition of real estate discrimination, not allowing African Americans to move into different neighborhoods, that students were being steered. There was a discussion about desegregation of the schools that had the city pretty tense. There had been some resistance to doing so. There is also a recognition that there are limited retail and job opportunities, especially for young African-American men and women in the city, because this is the time that the mall sort of phenomena began, that neighborhoods began to lose their retail businesses. They would not hire African-Americans, or there were many stores that were being shuttered along Division Avenue. There was a full-scale transition, as in many places. And so all these things sort of feed together, and the police are the most visible part of city government in a sense that they're being hassled. Paul Phillips had warned against that sort of thing, that there was a real hostility. There was a lot of tinder lying around for that spark. It's during the time of the long hot summers. There's a lot of unrest.
Particularly the headlines coming out of Detroit at about the same time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, everybody's on edge. This is the time when you've also got television that can tell people what's going on. You can see it with a lot of immediacy. And there's the people that come out. There's a series of fires that are started. There's arrests. There's a lot of property damage. In Grand Rapids, there's less looting. There's more property damage. That you really take it out on the businesses and the symbols that tell people that they don't have an opportunity, that there's schools that aren't really serving the community with a high-level education. There have been a lot of reports that outline that. The businesses that wouldn't hire African-Americans, businesses that were white-owned that wouldn't serve African-Americans or hire them. There's a lot of anger, and it runs the fire department ragged.
So the fire department is certainly busy putting out fires. Did we have National Guard brought in? I mean, in Detroit, the 101st Airborne wound up coming in. What about in Grand Rapids?
No, they did not come in with the National Guard. What ended up with was about 220 some state troopers, other area local police departments. One of the things was that the city manager, Henry Neighbors, told the police chief, William Johnson, they said, don't mess around. They had to use a reasonable amount of force and not take any guff because this one's not going to get out of hand like Detroit. And the city had already sort of begun to think about that there was a real situation that could happen. I always sort of think it's sort of interesting that Detroit always is sort of portrayed as, oh, we didn't know it was going to happen, which is really not true. And it's really not true for Grand Rapids. People here, you know, in the city leadership knew that there was a lot of unrest. One of the big things that the city did that really sort of helped was that there had already been something called the task force. There was an outside consultancy that paired African-American community members with Grand Rapids police officers and sort of did role-playing and sort of relationship building. The police officers who were paired with the community members had visited the neighborhoods as civilians in civilian clothing, not as police officers, and sort of knew around. And the task force was deployed, and its members said that they did a lot of good, that they were able to head off a lot. In addition, there were a large number of injuries, but there's no deaths, amazingly. There's no sort of monumental events such as the Algiers Motel or other sorts of really brutal violence. There's a few reports of sniping. There's even questions that I've read whether or not they actually were sniping or people were just sort of imagining it. But it did not get nearly as out of hand, both between the efforts of, you know, community leaders, the police, and especially the community itself that did not come out and really sort of engage in that. The disturbance was under 1,000 people, and really a lot of people stayed in their homes, and in no small part because they knew the community members, that when these policemen arrived with these young men, they weren't viewed as sort of coming in as external force. They knew these people. They had a rapport. They were able to work with the community, and these young men could go out and really had that sort of trust and that credibility with the African-American community to help try to defuse that situation. The police officers themselves could speak to their colleagues and say, yeah, this isn't necessary. There's not a lot of sniping, and really keep the sort of out of control sense that it could really spiral into.
Over those 3 days, where in Grand Rapids did most of the disturbance happen?
Most of the disturbance is in the area along Division Avenue, around Hall Street, up to the north and the south. It's a very visible disturbance. It's in the sort of that large commercial district. It's a commercial backed up by residential areas. At that time, was a lot of transition in the retail area. And it's in the southeast part of the city, south of downtown. It's a relatively confined area. Unlike Detroit, where it spread very quickly throughout the city, in Grand Rapids, the police were able to close off the major arteries. They stopped the freeway and really took very proactive steps, both locally and at a distance, and with the task force could really move into the area quickly with both what you would call overwhelming force, but not with overwhelming violence. It was a sense more of to try to keep people from wandering around, and if people would look outside, they would see the police. They would maybe be visited or stopped by a task force members who said, yeah, it's really not worth it, don't go out, to really calm things quickly.
What changed in Grand Rapids after this uprising?
It really started a series of discussions about what was going on. It forced the city's leadership, who had already been aware of it, to really try to wrestle with this more. It also engaged things such as the Model Cities Program from the federal government to begin to develop more African-American community leaders, that this was an issue that could not be ignored, that the white community was going to have to address it. In a very controversial move, it meant an effort at school desegregation, which led to the closure of the increasingly African-American majority South High School, which had been at that time the city's most diverse high school, that had some pretty mixed outcomes, you know, leading to some clashes between students at Union High School on the west side when there was integration. It was a really difficult set of discussions, but it also meant that community members were now increasingly listened to, for better, for worse. Did it solve all the problems? No, it unfortunately did not, but it also meant that it also didn't fester or get swept under the rug quite as easily as other cities who just sort of said, well, we don't really want to see this problem. Grand Rapids did try to take more steps to address it, some which were more successful, others which were not, or at least were very controversial and left some pretty unhappy feelings in the area.
When you look at Detroit, Matthew Daly, especially some of the areas where most of the violence during that uprising happened, it's an area of the city still struggling to move on 50 years later. How do you think that compares to Grand Rapids in 2018?
Very much like Detroit, there are many areas that are still struggling with issues of quality housing, for employment opportunities, for recreation. That remains a challenge. For Grand Rapids, there was generally, even though there was a lot of looting and fires, there was far less physical damage. So when you go to those neighborhoods, many of those buildings are still standing. Some of them are not being used, but others are being redone or try to be adapted. Grand Rapids has experienced a massive, real change in the city's fabric, especially in the downtown and the west side of the city, with issues of affordable housing and population demographic changes. Down Division Avenue, there are some changes that are going on as development spreads down from downtown to the north. And so there are still a lot of challenges, but in many areas, if you go through, these are places that have a great deal of potential. They still have vibrant communities. They have churches, strong community groups, strong organizations. And these are places that, while they face a great many challenges, are very interesting places. When I go there, they're always welcoming. They're eager to talk history. They engage. They work with my students very excitedly. They're happy to work with us. And I think that's really exciting.
Grand Valley State University historian Matthew Daly. Thanks so much, Matthew.
Thank you. Appreciate it.